Welcome to the Fuller Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording, and it is 12:48 p.m. that is Pacific Standard Time. Today is December 23rd. Well, this is the big picture long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes for this week because of the holidays. And I thought we'd kick off with the U.S. Financial Conditions Index, but I think this is a good way to frame everything that's been going on this year and what we might anticipate for next year. And of course, it's been a pretty momentous year. We've had the pandemic has been the thing that everybody has been talking about incessantly. Then, of course, for the UK, Brexit has been going on for the last 3 years and perhaps is now coming to at least some form of conclusion, which is rather positive. And then we can think about everything that has happened in terms of the markets as well. Because 2021 is likely to be a year of reflation. But it's also likely to be a year where we start to think about debt in a more serious way. So when we look at this financial conditions index, it is at record lows. And this is when it's at lows, it means that financial conditions are very loose. When it's at highs, it means they're very tight. So back in 2008 and 9, it got to extraordinarily tight levels. And that was also equally the case in 2002. So for a very brief time in February and March, we got to a point where financial conditions were similar to what we saw immediately after at the conclusion of the TMT and post 9/11 bust, and then subsequently in the tightening phase that accompanied the taper tantrum in 2013 and 14. Well, central banks around the world moved with incredible speed, but perhaps none more so than the Federal Reserve, and they cut interest rates aggressively and unleashed what could really only, I think, adequately be described as a tsunami of liquidity into the markets. Well, they say that a rising tide raises all boats, and this tsunami washed huge numbers of stocks from lows to all-time highs, and from relative obscurity into stardom. Well, that has been particularly true, for example, of a company like Tesla. The share is up 600% this year. But on top of that, then they've also been able to raise more capital through share issuance this year than in all other years combined. That's a pretty phenomenal set of circumstances. Then when we think about, for example, Airbnb, that's a company that has just IPO'd. And it has been sitting as a private company for in excess of a decade. I remember when I first came to the USA, we used an Airbnb. And certainly our experience with Airbnbs in the USA has been really quite positive. And experience with them everywhere else has been quite negative. What it is highly dependent on is governance, or the sense of individual governance in different countries. That never seems to be talked about in terms of the financial press, or indeed in terms of just how exposed the company is to its reliance on the honesty and willingness to provide a strong and honest service from the people who are listing properties on it. But the interesting thing about Airbnb is that between its IPO earlier this month and the lows back in March, the valuation on the share rose by multiples. Now, there is absolutely no reason to think that the company is any different today than it was 6 months ago in any concrete fashion. But the tsunami of money that has been poured into the global markets over the course of this year has inflated the valuations of everything. So then Airbnb is now a $96.7 billion IPO, which is really quite extraordinary. When we think about the fact that DoorDash has also just IPO'd, well, then we're at a very similar chart pattern here, where it popped right off the open because so many of these companies are SPACs, and these special purpose acquisition companies often trade before the IPO at low valuations because they don't have any asset in them. Well, then the reality is that when the asset comes to market, it manufactures this pop on the upside immediately afterwards. And that's a very significant phenomenon. Because what it does is it ensures that there is a lot of media buzz around these companies. Of course, DoorDash is now a very significant company, $50 billion. When we then think about what it looks like in terms of the cash that it has, well, it's now got approximately $1.6 billion in cash, and it is losing approximately $500 million last year. We don't know what their free cash flow is going to be this year, but they're looking like they're going to lose about $60 billion. $60 million, I should say. So now the question is that going to be realizable that they believe that they're going to make money in 2021? Personally, I think it's rather unlikely. This just looks like some of the bump around the IPO, because the reality is that, I don't know about anybody else, but I hate getting food that's cold when it arrives, and it doesn't matter how swift the delivery service is. It's usually at least 20 minutes between when it comes out of the kitchen and onto your plate, and then it has to go through the elements in order to get to you. So this is not only an expensive proposition, but it's not a particularly effective one. And it's not like DoorDash doesn't have competition. So there are two different ways of thinking about it. The first is that through the IPO process, these companies, which are unlikely to actually make money, have got enough cash that they can persist for a while longer. Well, what that suggests is that trouble is not going to arise in the short term. And that was one of the biggest factors in supporting Uber, because during the IPO process, they took in a wad of cash, and that has been able to sustain the company all the way through this very difficult year. And it still has about $7 billion in cash, despite the fact that it's losing money every year and is unlikely to turn a profit, despite the fact that they have been shedding units from the business to simply focus on their pickups and rideshare business, and then also for their delivery business. Well, they're likely to be able to persist for at least another year. And the reality is that subsequently, they're either then going to have to raise prices enough to, one, damage their business and have a chance of potentially making a profit, or they'll go bust. Or they'll go back to the market and ask for more money. Well, obviously, that big question then for a lot of these companies is out on the horizon. It's somewhere beyond 2021, because as they come up for IPO, they get this infusion of cash that's enough to sustain them for a while longer. And when we look at the performance of some of the innovation ETFs, and ARK Innovation has been one of the more successful ones. They've been particularly effective in attracting capital. This ETF is now up to about $18.86 trillion. It looks almost identical to the IPO ETF, and it is accelerating higher. There is no other way that one can characterize this performance. When we then look at the IPO ETF, it's also been doing phenomenally well. So we have these extraordinarily loose financial conditions, we have interest rates that are very low, and we have a large number of private companies that have eschewed IPOs for a really quite prolonged time already, but they're now using this as an opportunity to sell. And of course, one of the lessons that David had taught for years at the chart seminar is, when is the best time to sell your company? Well, the easy answer is when you can get more for it than you think it's worth. And that would appear to be exactly what these people are doing. They're looking at the promise of extraordinary valuations, most particularly the acceleration in the price of companies like Tesla, but then also the acceleration in the price of, or the valuation attached to Airbnb, and thinking, well, golly, I'll have that too. So we're likely to have a significant number of additional IPOs next year. And among those are likely to be Coinbase as a Bitcoin exchange or a cryptocurrency exchange, Robinhood, which has been one of the big success stories this year. I think that Robinhood's success is very close to a parallel to the kind of phenomenon that I witnessed when I was a Bloomberg salesperson all the way back in the early 2000s. I'd been assigned to Belgium and Luxembourg, and I was going around to all the private banks servicing clients there and trying to get them to take additional terminals in the middle of a recession. And what was quite interesting was that there were large numbers of young people that had been hired during the 1990s to sell IPOs to all the new customers that the banks were getting. So that's all they did. They just went in and bought the IPOs and bought them all day, every day. And every new IPO, they were able to get access through the bank for their customers so that the clients could get into the newest IPO on the first day of trading. And they were doing fantastically well all the way through 1998, 1999, into early 2000. And by the time it came around to 2001 and 2002, they really didn't have very much to do, because none of them sold, and they sat through the entire subsequent bear market. And that represented a very difficult period for a lot of those asset managers and private banks. Well, instead of hiring lots of new people, then what instead, or the primary way that investors around the world have been gaining access to these IPOs has been through Robinhood, and it has done spectacularly well in facilitating the trading and the appetite for risk among retail investors. So it is likely to be one of the more hotly anticipated IPOs of 2021. So is Instacart, which is another one of these delivery companies. I do think that at some stage we're going to get a rationalization of the 2020 success stories. I'm particularly leery of Zoom Media. I think it's a rather dangerous one to try and short, simply because it does represent a rather large contract, but it is breaking down. And the reality is, it provides a terrible service. And on top of that, every time I've been using Zoom, then my computer slows down, and I do not have an old computer. And I do have at least it was a top-of-the-line graphics card when I bought it about 18 months ago. And even then, the demands that it's putting on my computer are rather high. But then they are also submitting to Chinese demands for censorship, and handing over information for Chinese dissidents because they participated in an anti-Tiananmen Square protest online is the kind of thing that should get any company in hot water. And it is likely to be existentially difficult, and most particularly because Zoom is far from the only alternative. And nobody is going to want to use it, particularly in the educational sphere, once this pandemic eventually ends. So when we start to really put together everything that's going on, we're still in an incredibly liquidity-rich environment. It's still representing the fuel for an accelerating environment among the growth companies. And growth does particularly well during periods of very low interest rates and abundant credit. So then we definitely need to pay attention to what's going on in terms of interest rates. Because the 10-year yield is back up to 94 basis points. It has base formation characteristics. So there has been this running question about whether the Federal Reserve will intervene to stop yields from rising. Now, they have clearly stated they don't want to do that. But the bigger point is, will they really have any choice? Because if we simply zoom in and look at the daily prices, there is a clear succession of higher reaction lows. Now, we've had a bit of back and forth over the last month, but the yield really hasn't gone anywhere. And obviously, 1% is a big psychological level, but it is back above the trend mean. The yield has on average been rising since August. There is a clear upward bias. And in the absence of a clear downward dynamic, then we have to give the benefit of the doubt to the potential that yields are going to push on the upside. Because the reality is that when you pour so much money into the market and the economy starts to recover, and then that money is not taken back out of circulation, then you deliberately foment inflation. Well, there are a number of different potential forms of inflation. Obviously, we've had asset price inflation this year, when we've seen these extraordinary moves prior to the pandemic. I mean, if you remember all the way back at the before, I think it was in January or February, there was this furore about the value that had been attached to a piece of art where it was a banana that had been taped to a wall. And it was I think it was something that happened all the way back I'm just looking it up because I want to get the dates right. But it was originally given a value of $120,000 at the art festival in Basel. And they even provided extra bananas so that you could replace it when it goes rotten. Now, I find at the time I thought it was rather amusing. But what I found even more amusing was the fact that people were willing to rationalize it, and that there was this competition to say that it really was a piece of art, and that it was something that was really valuable, and didn't it create this incredible way of thinking about value and the prices to and the impact of lifestyle and ennui on the world. But of course, it's all nonsense. I mean, it is one of the perfect examples of the emperor has no clothes. And when we start to think then about that happened in December of 2019, before all of this money hit the market in 2020, well, we have to at least pay some consideration to the fact that asset prices are rather high. And we've already had the asset price inflation. Now the big question is, are we going to have wage inflation? I rather think that it is inevitable, because the one thing that we've seen this year is this clear determination to try and support people throughout the pandemic. It's raised the question, therefore, of how much is enough. So there have been these very extraordinary social programs which are basically universal basic income, regardless of whether one wants to call it that or not, providing people money for doing nothing at an outsized rate, and in many cases above at rates above what they were making when they were working. Well, that does obviously raise the question. One doesn't have to be an economist or a PhD to think that if you give people more money for doing nothing than what they were doing, for what they were making when they were actually working, well, in their minds, it's going to devalue the rate at which they were willing to work. So they're going to demand something more. They're going to demand higher wages. When we look at the fact that a large number of companies have had to offer an additional couple of dollars an hour to people working in various retail organizations, not specifically for doing more work, because it was considered danger pay, it's going to be difficult for them to take that away. So, on the other hand, we have large numbers of people who are unemployed, and it will take time to get them back into work. Obviously, there is going to be this push and pull, because people are going to want to be paid more in order to take work, and there will be popular protest if they don't get adequately compensated for doing nothing. This obviously has inflationary pressures, and it is likely to put a significant burden on government fiscal conditions. And of course, that's not unique to any one country, but it's likely to be a global phenomenon, but most particularly in North America and in Europe. When we think, for example, that Germany, which is a highly capitalized country, and has seen its debt load increase by somewhere in the region of about $600 billion this year, they have been completely supplementing the lost earnings of companies this year. They've also been, that's also helped to ensure that people still get paid for doing nothing. So this has been a global phenomenon, and it is likely to cause some kind of inflationary demands in terms of wages. When we then think about the commodity complex, there are two, I think, important points. On the supply side, there have been issues with supply because of the pandemic, so that has helped to support prices. And then, of course, we have the clear intention of every government on earth to spur reflation. So they're going to spend as much as is required to get economic growth firing once more. That is most particularly true in China, where there is a very significant inventory build of industrial resources. They are going straight back to economics 101, and they're building and pouring money back into infrastructure. They're also looking at building more aircraft carriers, which is also another very significant quantity of steel that will be required. The continuous commodity index is up to 450. It's at new recovery highs. We haven't seen it at this level since 2015. It's in the process of completing the base formation. Obviously, it was looking like it was going to break the downtrend at the end of last year, and that was completely obviated in the first quarter. We've had this big V-shaped recovery up to October, and now it's breaking out once more. So we're in a new commodity bull market. We need to see lots and lots of back history to get some kind of perspective on how high prices could go and how low they were. Commodities relative to growth are at extraordinarily low levels. So when we think about what the value proposition is, commodities are cheap. and they have ample room in which to rally. Even if this were just a long-term range, the price could almost double over the next couple of years. I think it's rather important to look at long-term nominal charts and then also inflation-adjusted charts. So when we look at, for example, silver, it peaked in 1980 and then it exceeded the peak in nominal terms in 2011 and subsequently has rebounded rather impressively over the last couple of years. But when we then look at it on an inflation-adjusted basis, then we get a different environment overall. And when we then just do that, we can see clearly that although we've had a big move in 2011 on an inflation-adjusted basis, the relative advance was considerably less. But even here, we're looking at prices coming off of extraordinarily low levels. And I think this is something that we're seeing in a large number of other commodities. So copper prices have been leading on the upside. And they have been pausing in the region of the previous peaks from 2017 and 18 this week. But copper in particular has got a lot going for it because it not only has a supply deficit scenario, but it also has the demand, the new demand story coming through. A 1 megawatt wind turbine requires 3 tons of copper. There is twice as much copper in an electric vehicle as there is in a conventional vehicle. When we start to think about the quantity of copper that's required for recharging facilities, it's also high. And that is before we start to think about the conventional way of using copper for wiring or for conducting anything. So there hasn't been a new copper mine come online in nearly a decade. The last big one was the Oyo Toigo mine in Mongolia, and that still hasn't reached full production. When we look at some of these big miners with large copper production facilities like Rio Tinto, they have been trying to bolster their ESG credentials by saying that they're the number one green energy miner, and the share continues to pull away from the 5,000 level, and it is closing in on the peaks put in back in 2008. So we're seeing that the metal prices are coming off of rather depressed levels, but some of the miners have been doing substantially better than that. When we think about BHP Billiton, it went through the big demerger with South32, and it is now coming back up towards the upper side of what is basically an 8-year base formation. So this, I think, is rather important as well. We're at a point where there is a great deal of money getting poured into renewable energy. Now, there are two ways of thinking about it. The first is that it is a function of this incredibly liquid environment overall with very low interest rates. And I think there is certainly some rationale behind that. We've had this incredible advance in solar and wind, and it has continued. So we've had this spectacular acceleration. The solar sector did nothing but rally this week. It continues to extend its advance. It's very overbought, and at least likely for another one of these consolidations, which have been limited to about a $10 decline. A move more than that would be likely to signal a peak of more than short-term significance. But the liquidity-rich environment has been the dominant factor. But then we also have the point that it had already been breaking out in late 2019, and that dependence on high oil prices, that broke down in 2019. We can see that prices really hadn't been going anywhere all the way through 2019, but renewable energy moved to a position of outperformance. So we can think then that it might be because investors are more willing to look at the trend of regulation than they are willing to think about cost differentials and the requirement that oil prices need to be high in order to justify investment in renewables. But the other way of thinking about it is that the trend is clear and the technology is good enough, and that the trend of the technological improvements is very much in favor of renewables. The trend of the regulatory environment is very much in favor of renewables. And the trend of investment in new infrastructure is very much in favor of renewables. And then the geopolitical context is in favor of renewables. Because the big thing that happened in the last decade was that the USA went from being the biggest energy importer to being a net exporter. While it was still an importer, then it was a priority to ensure security in the Middle East, and it didn't really represent a point of competition between the USA and other great powers. But now that the USA is an energy exporter, it's at a point of competition with other exporters, but most particularly, it's also at a point of competition with the major importers, because they were never competing before, because they were all importers. Now the USA has a clear geopolitical advantage, which it could easily press in a wartime situation. Therefore, Europe and China have a very clear geopolitical imperative to try and limit their dependence on imported energy. And they have both concluded that renewables is the way to go. So that is clearly at being one of the big tailwinds for energy. And the wind sector continues to march higher. We do need to put in context that we are now coming back towards prices that prevailed ahead of the crash in 2008. And the massive investments that we're getting in renewables, it might yet turn out to be another form of destruction of capital, because replacement cycle for these pieces of infrastructure is much shorter than it is for conventional fossil fuels. And these talk about wind turbines lasting for 20 years, there's just no way that we're going to know whether that is in fact true until 20 years have actually passed. But I think every single wind farm I have driven past over the years, I've never seen all of them working at once. And then when we think about solar panels, then where they work best is often where there's a lot of dust. And that obviously results in lower efficiency over many years. But the reality is that as long as money is available, then these installations will persist. We think about the business model of Sunrun, it's 100% dependent on low interest rates. And as long as interest rates are low, then their ability to install and wait for the cash flows to compensate them for the cost of introducing the infrastructure, it's a viable business. But if interest rates rise, then the company goes bust. So everything in many respects depends on what happens with interest rates. There are some sectors that will benefit from an inflationary bias, but high growth is wholly dependent on access to liquidity and low interest rates. One thing that has been very clear this over the last 6 or 7 weeks has been the transition away from high growth and big market caps to high growth and somewhat smaller market caps. Google is one of the only companies in the mega cap sector that has been able to break out to new highs in the last quarter. If we then think about Microsoft, it has been mostly ranging now since September. Apple, despite the fact that they claim they're going to try and make a vehicle, has been mostly range bound since September as well. Netflix is another company that is heavily dependent on low interest rates and access to liquidity, has also been going sideways to down since August. What this is saying is that the companies that led on the upside are now moving to underperformance. This is a warning. Leaders lead for a reason, and leaders lead in both directions. And leadership is not just about relative strength. It's a temporal designation. It talks about the timing of the market. If we then just think about Netflix, it pioneered streaming. It invented a wholly new sector, and the share price has done spectacularly well since 2012, going from really single digits to $500 is extraordinary by any stretch of the imagination. Now it's at a point where liquidity is still abundant, and yet the share price has stopped rising. Interest rates are still low, but the share price has stopped rising. And this was a company that was one of the most aggressive borrowers. And there are big questions about whether it will ever turn a profit. And they do anticipate that they'll have net free cash flow this year after one of the biggest shocks to the global market ever. And then as we move into 2021, they anticipate going back into negative territory. And this is the question. After growing to a point where they now have millions, or if not hundreds of millions, of subscribers and still can't make positive money, well, obviously then that does raise the question about what the sustainability of the business model is. And then if we think about Disney, they've done spectacularly well by taking on Netflix's business model and running with it. So that has been one of the more significant factors. Now, I do seem to be getting some intermittency in my internet connection, and I hope that this starts to come through. Disney has popped on the upside over the course of the last few weeks, and they are looking increasingly at going more to a streaming model. So it's quite likely that the model will have successfully transitioned the entire entertainment business to consumption and first-person consumption, whereas the pioneer of the business model may not in fact survive. And that is something that we see in lots of different cycles, that the pioneers of new ideas, they flash out, and the technology and know-how that they introduce changes the entire market, and the best capitalized and those with the greatest creativity and presence in the market then generally tend to do better later. When we start to think then about Where are the opportunities? Well, I think that there are clear risks in growth, but that it's not over yet. There are obviously base formations in terms of interest rates. And this is why I think that the yield curve spread is something that we do need to continue to pay attention to. I really did think that they would try and defend the 70 basis point level, and so far I've been wrong. The yield curve spread has continued to march higher. It's now at 82 basis points. But the reality is that with deficits where they are, and with the fact that the U.S. Government is anticipating seeing an even bigger deficit, or at least a very large deficit in 2021 as well, then the question about the sustainability of the debt is going to start to move front and center. It will particularly be the case when we start to see inflationary pressures rising, and it is quite likely that we're going to see inflationary pressures moving up as we come into the end of the first quarter. And there's a simple reason for that, because of the relative comparisons. When we look at where prices are today relative to where they were at the end of the first quarter, we're going to have some very big changes in terms of the price pressures. So when we start to think about inflation, well, we have the potential for wage inflation. We already have asset price inflation. And then we have the scope that this massive amount of money that's been printed staying in the market during a reflation is likely to have a very significant effect. There are obviously massive amounts of money moving around which are helping the renewable energy sector. It does have the longevity factor in that these regulatory moves that are being put in place, particularly in Europe but around the world, are long-term in nature. When we then think about the hydrogen sector, it continues to march higher. ITM Power was up in a very impressive manner this week and is pushing on again from the most recent consolidation. This has been a really incredibly impressive move over the last 2 years, and it has now taken out the peak from back in 2006. The one thing that I think is important to highlight is when we think about, and sorry, I mistyped there, when we think about the size of the industry, having had an incredible advance, this is still only a $2.5 billion company. When we think about Ceres Power, it's a $2 billion company. And this is in the energy sector, where market caps in the order of hundreds of billions are not unusual. Well, at least they were not unusual before the energy sector crashed into ignominy over the course of the last couple of years. But hydrogen and anything related to hydrogen is likely to continue to advance because there is massive investment in infrastructure. And this is another example of where capital is likely to be destroyed, because it's all being done on the promise of efficiencies. And maybe we're going to see that there will be efficiencies delivered in terms of the cost of production, and more importantly, perhaps, in terms of the cost of transportation. But that is not stopping the massive amount of money that is flowing into the sector today. And it's likely to continue as long as interest rates remain low. When interest rates begin to rise, well, then we'll probably have a reaction, perhaps even a medium-term correction. And it could be a couple of years before they start to move again. But this is very clearly well within the hype cycle today. And these companies are very small, so they have a lot of room in which to rally before things start to get difficult for them. I think that is probably where we're going to see the biggest moves in energy. We're going to see a commodity bull market, but it's more likely to be in renewable energy metals than it is in the conventional industrial metals. Lithium, for example, has just broken out of its at more than it was almost a 3-year downtrend. So there is clear scope here that we're going to see increasing demand for lithium batteries. When we think about the performance of CATL in China, then it has been trending higher for basically all year. And China is doing whatever it takes to become the globally dominant producer of batteries. They obviously want to try and dominate the future global sector, but also to supply their domestic needs. And then when we think about, well, what is it that Apple is actually going to do? Are they really serious about building their own factories? Or are they going to pursue the same business model they've done for most of the last 20 or even 30 years, which has been to outsource manufacturing and insource design? If they deploy an OEM business model to the automotive sector, then it will catapult them into one of the most dominant in the world. Because if they simply think about the powertrain as a commodity rather than a differentiation point, and simply focus on where their strengths are, which is in technology and ease of use, then they do have a viable business model. Of course, what it means is that they will need ready supplies of automotive batteries. And that pretty much means that their manufacturing will take place in China. And the reality is that China is now the largest automotive market, and Apple has a very successful Chinese business already. So they've said that they're going into the automotive business. They have not said where the first car will be released, and they haven't said anything about how those cars are going to be manufactured. But Sergio Marchionne, who used to be the CEO of Fiat Chrysler, he predicted an OEM business model for the automotive sector back in 2015. Nobody has really tried it yet, but Volkswagen and Toyota at least come close, where, for example, a Volkswagen Jetta or a Passat has got the same chassis as an Audi A4. So they have at least some substitution of the component parts, and then the true difference would be in the trim and performance of the engines. Well, if the trend, therefore, is in commoditization of the powertrain, which is basically what electric vehicles provide, because there isn't a great deal of difference between the different kinds of batteries, most particularly because Tesla is open sourcing its battery designs. Elon Musk really does want to try and change the world. And by not holding on to the intellectual property, then that's obviously something that is going to commoditize the whole automotive sector. What it really does then mean that there's going to be massive rationalization in the automotive sector. That is going to represent a huge challenge for the countries that have historically depended on automotives. So it's going to be a challenge for the newly independent UK. It'll be a challenge for France and Germany as well. Obviously, some companies will do better than others, but quite whether there really is going to be a future for companies like Peugeot or Citroën or all these independent marques, they're doing well at present. But do they have potential to do better? Will they survive the onslaught of the or the evolution of the battery sector. One thing we know is that Toyota has a demonstration vehicle for a solid state battery. Back in July of this year, they had not yet solved the question of how to mass produce these batteries. So the share has not yet broken on the upside. At the moment, they may only have a test vehicle or a prototype that they had been hoping to show off to the world at the Tokyo Olympics. They may just wait until 2021 to do that. But we are getting increasingly close to the kinds of innovations that will double the range of electric vehicles. And the economies of scale in terms of producing batteries are making them rapidly competitive with internal combustion engines. The big difference, though, is that the safety concerns with current chemistries are relevant. And really, to have an electric vehicle, what you also need is your own home. Most apartment buildings do not have charging facilities, and access to rapid charging is not easily available, and people don't really have the time either to spend all day waiting for their car to recharge. So these are challenges in the short term, but they're not challenges in the medium term. And then, of course, we're likely to have a very significant need for utilities to migrate to this evolutionary environment where there will be greater demand for electricity. And for the first time, there is competition for what will provide that electricity. That's why there is this big move in terms of wind and solar, and increasingly in hydrogen, because of this competitive environment for the businesses, for the demand from utilities. When we then think about what's likely in terms of stock markets as we look into 2021, I think the reflation trade is going to continue to favor cyclicals. So industrials, materials, and the consumer sector will continue to outperform. Obviously, what we're seeing today are a lot of very scary headlines about the new strain of the coronavirus, which is proliferating in the UK right now and has already spread to a handful of additional countries, and probably considerably more than that. In fact, it probably reached the UK from South Africa in the first place. And it is upwards of 70% more transmissible than the virus that people have been dealing with for the last 6 months. It doesn't necessarily mean it's more fatal, but it does heighten the risk that more people will get it. Well, obviously against that, the fear and the threat of additional lockdowns, and in fact the reality of additional lockdowns, the biotechnology sector continues to do well. The reality is that these companies have clearly said that they are quite capable of producing additional vaccines that can deal with any mutation of the coronavirus. There is already being work going on to create a universal vaccine for the flu. So that is something that is out there on the horizon. And then we can start to think about other potential applications. When we start to think about how much money and lost productive capacity does the global economy lose as a result of the flu every year, well, it has to be into the hundreds of billions. But then what I think few people understand is that the amount of spending that goes into oncology in a year is on par with the entire global expenditure on energy. And that represents an incredible tax on both production and consumption. So if these technologies, which are genetically based, can also be used to target the cancer complex, then the potential for growth and the freeing up of resources for other productive activities is practically unparalleled. That's a very good reason to think about biotechnology as a significant bull market phenomenon, but most particularly because it hasn't done anything for 6 years, and it's really only just breaking out now. The potential for growth in this sector is really quite unparalleled for the simple reason that the first DNA sequence for a human being was only completed less than 20 years ago. And we are now at a stage where a vaccine for a novel disease can be produced in days. Now, it still takes us months to go through the trial phase to ensure that it is both safe and efficacious. But the fact that it could be produced in days relative to what was the norm before, which could take anything from years to a decade, is a wholly new phenomenon. So the pace of technological innovation is not going to stop. And in fact, it's accelerating. The fact that Google has been able to deploy artificial intelligence and deep learning and what is effectively a computer teaching itself. So we're talking about the neural net way of programming a system so that they could solve the protein folding problem. And this is not just a great achievement in terms of what they've been able to do so far, but the iteration from the last competition that they entered, which was 2 years ago. So they have been able to improve the ability of the program by orders of magnitude in just 2 years. About a year ago, the Google quantum computing team said that they were enhancing quantum computing at an exponential rate, which means that it was going in exponents rather than times. In other words, instead of going 2, 4, 8, it was going 2, 4, 16. And then when you start thinking about how quickly that iterates and the pace of innovation that occurs, well, it's a really good reason why Google is outperforming those other companies, because the kinds of things it's been spending its money on in terms of innovation have the real potential to change the world. And that is just not the case with the kinds of money and innovation that some of the other companies have been pouring their resources into. And then when we think about, well, what is the likelihood from or the knock-on effect of all of this money being printed and the scope for inflation? Well, gold prices are now consolidating in the region of the peak from 2011, and they've been coming down now for most of the last couple of months. In fact, they've been trending downwards since approximately August. And anyone who's been trading gold over the last 20 years knows that it seldom does what you want it to do. And it can be maddeningly difficult in terms of how long it can spend doing nothing. And then when it does well, it tends to put in extraordinary moves in very short periods of time. and people tend to get euphoric very quickly, and then they get they move into despair rather quickly, and large numbers of people exit the market, and then they are encouraged back in when it breaks out again. Well, we're in a corrective phase for gold. It is right in the region of the 200-day moving average and the peak from 2011. It's a natural area where we could anticipate some support coming through, and we are seeing evidence of support coming through, but we're still in a negative real interest rate environment, and that is by far the hardest fundamental behind gold. And that's also, I think, one of the things that people tend to understand least about the outlook for gold. It's not about inflation or deflation. It's about negative real interest rates, because you can have negative real interest rates in an inflationary environment. The only time you don't have negative real interest rates during inflation is when central banks get really serious about trying to quell inflation. But we're just not there at the moment. In fact, we're at the exact opposite end of the scale, because governments the world over are courting inflation. They're doing everything they possibly can to try and inflate the debts away. Arguably, they tried doing that immediately after the last crisis in 2008. But what they did instead was create this massive asset price inflation. Well, this time around, they're just doubling down. So we are at a point where modern monetary theory is real. Now, in many respects, I think that if we look at the way that the high-tech sector is performing, we can look at the financial conditions financial conditions index again. Because the thing I think is most relevant about it is to look at what financial conditions were like all the way back in 1998 and 1999. They contracted around the time of the long-term capital management bailout, and they stayed very accommodative all the way through until the first quarter of 2000. And then the Federal Reserve started raising interest rates, and it basically killed speculation. Well, it's possible that we're entering a similar situation right now, that long-term capital management scared policymakers, and they kept interest rates low for longer than was necessary, and they maintained a great deal of liquidity in the market, which really spurred the bubbly environment. And perhaps we're now in a similar situation, because the pandemic has scared everyone, not just policymakers. And the last thing they want to do is to create a more difficult economic environment. So they are now going to leave interest rates low for as long as it takes for inflation to start trending higher. That's basically what moving to an average inflation rate means. They don't just want to see it pop up, they want to see it sustained up. So in other words, they want a sustained breakout in inflation. And that is trending. Well, that pretty much means that we're going to have very benign financial conditions for a prolonged period. It means that we could easily see bubbly conditions evolve. And arguably the best candidates for that right now are in the renewable energy sector, but also in the new IPOs sector. Because these are the sectors that do best in a low interest rate, liquidity rich environment. But what we are also now seeing is that commodities are coming off of extremely depressed levels. They're benefiting from this move into renewables, but they're also benefiting from reflation. Reflation in an environment where we have very liquid environments means inflation has to be part of the potential realm of the possible. And if inflationary pressures rise, then the negative real interest rates are going to become even more negative. And that is likely to represent a very significant tailwind for real assets like gold, because the clear intention of governments is to devalue their currencies and to basically rob savers. So it is savers are going to see the biggest loss of purchasing power, and the only way to avoid that will be to speculate. Whether it is to speculate in the high growth sectors or to speculate in the potential for hard assets to hold out relative to the inflationary onslaught, those are the two big factors that are evolving in this market. When we think about what's going on in terms of Brexit, well, on the one hand, we have a global order which has been coalescing in terms of globalization for most of the last 40 years. And Brexit is a symptom of the changes that are going on. We're moving increasingly back towards a looser international framework, much more mercantilist in terms of trade and individual sovereignty. Then, of course, the EU is going in the opposite direction. They want to create a federal state. Perhaps the most contrarian view there is that in this competition between the USA and China, it will be Europe will be the big beneficiary and the euro will become the next reserve currency. And that is so far out there on the fringes that it's hardly even considered to be a fringe idea. In fact, it is such a contrarian idea, I find it hard to give it any real credibility other than the fact that Europe has a population of upwards of 500 million and relatively less debt than on aggregate, as opposed to individual countries, than just about anywhere else. So if they do go federal and they try to solve their problems, and they not just try, but succeed in solving some of their problems, then Europe will become more of a viable area in terms of a safe haven. And one way of thinking about the massive quantity of debt that has got a negative interest rate is that the majority of it is European, and it is a vote of confidence in Europe's ability to service its debts. The reality is that countries like Germany are borrowing at negative interest rates. People are willing to pay them to take their money. And that is a very benign environment for any government to be in. As we look towards 2021, by the end of the first quarter, there will be hundreds of millions of people will have been vaccinated. The threat from the coronavirus will be starting to recede. Reflation will be underway. There is a huge amount of cash built up on the sidelines, both in the corporate sector and in the personal sector, that will be deployed into a restoration period. If we think about the changes that occurred in the UK after the Puritans, the Puritanical period and the restoration period of Charles II, it's just a simple parallel with what we're likely to see in 2021 as the virus recedes. And as people get back into enjoying themselves, then joie de vivre and you only live once are probably going to be the things that most actively the people get into. It's probably a benign environment for the UK to venture off into the global environment. But I think perhaps the one thing that UK politicians will miss more than anything is the ability to blame everything that goes wrong on Europe. Now is the time when they're going to have to come up with real policies to plot the the root of the UK in a new environment, and they're going to have to deliver on better standards of living. The benefit from an investor's perspective is that the pound is comparatively cheap when compared to the US dollar. Compared to the euro, it's very close to its lows. And then UK valuations are at a discount relative to every other developed market. And of course, the UK is one of the places with the most listed miners. It has a large financial sector, and it has probably more hydrogen companies listed than any other major market. In other words, the UK is probably a market that is very well positioned for higher interest rates, and that is likely to also be a point of attraction from the perspective of investors as we look towards the reflation of the global economy. And I'd like to wish everyone a Merry Christmas, a happy holiday period, and I'm looking forward to seeing what happens over the Christmas period in terms of little changes in the markets, and looking forward to a prosperous 2021.